I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We read the stories about schools in our morning newspaper. The 14-year-old girl who's handcuffed and sent to juvenile court because she's violated the dress code. A 12-year-old boy, a straight-A student in a 6th-grade classroom in Oklahoma who points his finger, like a gun, at a classmate. He's yanked out of class, patted down, swept with a metal detector, and suspended for 5 days. Under the post-Columbine rules of school, under the inflexibility of zero tolerance, this is the face of school discipline today. Teachers and principals are obliged to report suspensions to the courts. Policemen with guns patrol the hallways. Currently in America, 3 million students are suspended each year. 100,000 are expelled. Is it that more kids are going bad and schools just can't handle it? Or are the police and the courts simply better equipped to mete out school discipline? Is this the system we want? Or are there other options? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start our program today with a quick glimpse of the Elk Grove Unified School District just south of Sacramento in Central California. There are 10 high schools there with a student population that has almost doubled in the last 10 years, a mix of rich and poor kids. David Gordon is superintendent. He's joining us from the studios of KXJZ in Sacramento. David, it's good to have you with us.
Good morning. Happy to be with you again.
If I were to get in a car with you and drive to one of the high schools, say in one of your rougher neighborhoods in Elk Grove, what would be the first thing that I would see?
Well, you'd see some welcoming people out at the entrance to the school. You'd see one of our sheriff's patrol cars out there. You would meet the principal. We'd have in an office right off of the school office the deputy sheriff who's assigned to the school, who's there all day, every day during school, and he's there not to hook kids up and take them down to jail, but to get to know the students, get to know the faculty, and become someone who is a preventer of problems rather than someone who is correcting problems.
Now, you park that patrol car out front with a very specific purpose, don't you?
Yes, we do, because if someone who's out to do mischief sees a patrol car, they're more likely to keep on going and do their mischief someplace else.
And let's talk about the way that discipline, well, not so much the way that discipline is enforced, but the way that you use police officers in or security officers in the high schools in particular. You mentioned the county sheriff's office provides a full-time deputy sheriff for each of the high schools that requires that, right?
That's correct.
But you have your own school security force as well, don't you?
We have a small police force of sworn officers, 5 or 6 of those. Then we have 20 or so security personnel, unarmed, who mostly do patrol, protecting our properties. We have 70 or 80 major buildings in the school district. But in the schools, we call them school resource officers. Their role is really to monitor, educate, and enforce, with the emphasis on educate. The idea is to work within our school's discipline policy to make sure students understand what the rules are, why they exist, and what the consequences are for violating them.
Now, most of these people are carrying guns, David?
The school resource officers carry guns. The 5 or 6 school police that we have that back up the resource officers carry guns. The security officers do not.
The resource officer. I noticed that there's a National Association of Resource Officers. In fact, a story that I was reading in this morning's paper says that school safety is the fastest growing area of law enforcement in the country. Where did that name come from, resource officer?
Well, I think it's a term of art within the law enforcement community to describe a person who's assigned to a school to have expressly different roles than a street patrol officer. And that role, again, is really to get to know the culture and the climate of the school and to enhance safety at the school in a variety of ways.
I was struck, David, in going through my notes last night about Elk Grove. One of the things that you were telling a producer here at the program is that the idea of having police officers in the schools hasn't always worked that well. You're happy with it now, but it wasn't great earlier, right?
We had, 8 or 9 years ago when I became superintendent, a police force in place that was dysfunctional. It was the old style of approaching children. So we ended up actually disbanding it, canceling it, closing it down. And then we reinstituted it a couple of years later under a very different set of expectations. And the person who's our chief was a former teacher, vice principal, and principal within our district, as well as having been a sheriff's deputy in a past career. And the tone he has set is markedly different. It's a tone of how do we prevent problems from occurring? How do we reach out to families and make sure they understand what our safety policies are and why they exist?
Is there a part of you that wishes you didn't have to put people, uniformed people with guns in the school, that there was a way of having the old school system of teachers and principals and ultimately you, the superintendent, managing the discipline problems there?
No question. No question that would be a wonderful day if it could again be with us. But I don't know that it's really ever been with us. There have always been dangers and threats. And one of the things that we emphasize in talking with our parents and our community is it isn't just us that needs to work hard to protect our kids. It's everybody. And a good example is we tell parents if you see strange behaviors that kids are exhibiting, not just your kids, their friends, let us know. Let us look into it, and we can confidentially look into situations and potentially prevent problems. But the problems are out there. There are many troubled kids and troubled family situations, and we've got to be mindful of that.
I got a copy of the Elk Grove Unified School District Zero Tolerance Code that, you know, for students and for parents in the schools, the expectations for all different parties. If there wasn't a code of zero tolerance, would that be a good thing, or would that make life more difficult in terms of trying to figure out how to manage discipline at high schools in your area?
Well, the zero tolerance, I think it needs to be explained that under our state law, there are three sorts of things that mandate expulsion. Number one is if you're selling drugs. Number two is if you bring a weapon to school. And number three is a serious or violent assault. And I would argue that we don't want kids who display any of those behaviors around our schools. All of the other offenses you see in the code of conduct are things that we seek to prevent by putting the information out that these are our standards, this is what we expect in the way of behavior. And as you saw in the code of conduct, it's very clear that everyone has a responsibility, the parents and the family, the students themselves, and also the school. And that's the approach we try to take.
Let's bring Richard Arum into the conversation now. 15 years ago, Richard was teaching English at the Castlemount High School in Oakland, California. He's now an assistant professor of sociology and education at New York University. He has a new book called Judging School Discipline. Richard's joining us from New York. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thanks, Dick.
When you were working as a teacher at Castlemount, was it a difficult time? This is late 80s, early 90s, right?
That's correct. Castlemont High School was a high school in Oakland, California that experienced a high degree of violence and disorder in the classrooms and in the halls.
Were you ever threatened? Were you ever attacked?
I can't say that personally I felt physically at danger in ever in my 5 years working there, although many of my colleagues not only did face danger, but actually had been physically assaulted when I was teaching there.
Now, was zero tolerance in place at that time, Richard?
No, we did not have zero tolerance policies, but we worked as, you know, teachers, parents, administrators came together and attempted to consider measures that would be necessary to take there to kind of restore safety and order at the school there.
Now, as David's just explained, Castlemont will have zero tolerance now because it's state law. In your new book, you're saying that zero tolerance is, in fact, part of the problem here rather than part of the solution. Explain that for me.
Well, I think we have to understand why zero tolerance policies have come about, why zero tolerance policies are necessary. What is it about schools that have led to disorder occurring at the levels that are occurring today? In my book, I discuss not only changes in society, but changes in the legal environment around schools that have made ordinary day-to-day disciplining of youth much more difficult.
And you're saying that it's, in fact, made more difficult by the fact that the school has, for a number of reasons, handed a lot of that responsibility over to law enforcement people rather than school counselors or teachers or principals.
Well, I think they hand over discipline to outside authorities because they've been denied the moral authority and the discretion to pursue ordinary discipline in the ways that were traditionally done in our society.
You said denied the moral authority. Who denied them the moral authority? Was it actually taken away from them?
Yes, indeed. I think that was exactly what occurred in the late 60s and early 70s. A legal field emerged in this country that explicitly was interested in expanding youth rights in schools. This effort was advanced by not only public interest lawyers, but by federal sponsorship through the Legal Services Program and the Center for Law and Education at Harvard. This was a federally funded effort to expand youth rights in schools. The most important case that came out of that effort was the Goss v. Lopez case in 1975.
We'll talk about the details of that just in a minute, but I want to go back to David Gordon here on the idea of having moral authority taken away by kids who, through the courts or through whatever reason, David, have the feeling that you can't touch me, you can't hit me, you can't discipline me, I can take you to court. Do you get that kind of pushback from students as you hear it described by Richard?
Well, only in very rare cases, but I think that's because our local Board of Education, which has a number of members who've been around 20-odd years, have taken a very strong stand, which is strongly supported by parents, that we need to have standards of deportment and behavior in our schools, because if we don't, we can't pursue our fundamental mission, which is educating children, improving their performance, getting them into college.
And whose responsibility is it to enforce those standards of deportment and behavior?
Well, it's a joint responsibility, and that's why when we suspend a child and we suspend children at the first signs of bad behavior, because then we call the parent in and we show them the code of conduct and remind them, you got this in the mail, do you remember? Mm-hmm. And we need your help to turn your child's behavior around. And generally speaking, parents are extremely supportive of that approach.
Connection listeners all across this country, parents, school board officials, teachers, principals, students are trying to come to terms with, figure out a way of managing school discipline in a way that doesn't necessarily mean a pair of handcuffs or the extreme use of zero tolerance policies. What's your experience? What's your view about the way the system's working and how it might be improved? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're back right after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. In this hour-long conversation about school discipline, we have with us from New York Richard Arum. He's former teacher, now sociology and education professor at NYU, and author of a new book called Judging School Discipline, The Crisis of Moral Authority. David Gordon is with us from the Elk Grove Unified School District in Sacramento County, California. That's a district which is half suburban, half urban, with a good mix of students, both racially and economically. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're now going to Burlington, Vermont, where Valerie's joining us. Hi, Valerie. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. I'll give you my background. I'm a teacher with a master's degree, about 12, 13 years of experience. I've taught grades K through 9 in both Washington, D.C., and now in a much smaller town of Burlington, Vermont. And I have to agree with Mr. Arum that the crux of the matter is that we as teachers have lost our authority. And I just feel so discouraged at the defensive posture that we need to take at this point. I mean, I feel that the parents do not necessarily take a call from a teacher and listen thoroughly to what's happened. They immediately take the child's side. I have had children, as you mentioned earlier, say, you know, take your hands off me when I've put my hand on a shoulder to talk with them about a misbehavior. You know, you can't touch me. I'm going to tell my mom, this kind of thing. And it's just become such a terrible climate that I'm on leave with my children, and I just get more and more discouraged about going back. And how do I carve out the time for teaching?
Valerie, what happens if you've got a student who's really acting up in the classroom, not necessarily hurting anybody, maybe not even using foul or abusive language or threatening you, but just kind of like out of control? What are the school rules?
Well, the bottom line is you have to create the culture within the classroom. I haven't always had the feeling that the culture was in the school at large, but in your classroom about what's acceptable and what's not. And so hopefully you've developed a personal relationship where a word, a look, a conversation, a pulling aside is effective enough.
I get that. That's the skill of a teacher. But if that's not working, what's your next option? What does the school say?
There aren't many. I mean, there are restrictions against holding kids during recess, against holding kids after school, depending on their transportation and their parents' wishes. If you call the parent, you don't necessarily get the support. If you send to the principal's pulled in a million directions. It may not be attended to quickly or effectively. I don't feel that there are many options for these lower-level issues, which ultimately escalate into the larger stuff.
Valerie, I want to thank you for your call. Yeah, David, is that you?
Dick, no, Richard Arum.
Okay,
New York.
Richard,
let
go ahead.
Let me jump in here. I find it very kind of ironic, actually troubling, you know, the earlier comments that David made, that one of the solutions is to make police more effective educators. That is, you know, it's not the old forms of policing. These are going to be new forms where police are trained to be better educators. Well, you know, instead of making police more effective educators, I think what we should be working on is making educators more effective at disciplining and socializing youth. And it seems like educators should be focused on that as an issue rather than attempting to make police police interventions in schools more humane.
Okay, I want to go to David in a minute, Richard.
Hang on, David, just half a sec.
Because I want to clarify something with Richard. You say make teachers better disciplinarians, but Richard, you were saying earlier that the teachers don't have the opportunity, they don't have the wherewithal, the school support to be a disciplinarian.
No, not without significant legal reform occurring in our society. But I think the trouble with, you know, sending police and these zero tolerance measures that are being advocated is that it fundamentally misunderstands how discipline can be effective and constructive in the lives of students. Discipline is not simply to allow the education process to occur smoothly and easily in the classroom. Rather, discipline's function in schools is to help socialize youth to internalize the rules, norms, values of society as their own. Those discipline can only work when it is seen as legitimate and fair. Police walking.
You're talking
down
about
the hall.
Setting examples, creating an atmosphere where the kids do behave properly because they believe that's the way they should behave, rather than someone's going to yank them out of class, right?
That teachers and administrators have the moral authority to control behavior because they are acting in the common interest of the school community.
Okay, David Gordon, hop back in here.
Yeah, I think Richard's putting words in my mouth a bit, because I didn't say that the policeman was our discipline program. I said that that was a part and just a part of what we do. And the police officer's approach to children is what we have worked hard to change. The idea is you don't hook up the student automatically and take them downtown. You work with us and work within our discipline system, and the police officer is the last resort. The moral authority comes, and Dick, you read the code of conduct, from a persistent educating of people in the community and parents that these are the standards we seek to maintain. and the teachers understand that they will be supported in instances where the standards aren't maintained, that the parent will be called in, a suspension will be done in order to prevent a further erosion of the behavior, which would lead to more serious incidents. And that is why the discipline program we have in the Code of Conduct goes from grade K through 12, because if you work with students on encouraging and modeling proper behavior in K through 6, you will have less problems down the road. And let me give you an interesting statistic. With as much emphasis as we have put on discipline, you would think we would expel huge numbers of children in our district. Let me give you these figures. 1995, the year I became superintendent, we had 30,000 children in the district. We expelled 202 students. 2002, we had 52,000 students. We expelled 145 students. So it's not kicking kids out the door that's doing this. It's the persistent emphasis on a standard of behavior and giving everybody the legitimacy and the authority to enforce that.
But if the authority in that school, David, comes at some point and at some level from someone who's wearing a gun in a holster, isn't it then a little bit more authoritarian than the sort of moral authority that, Richard's talking about, even psychologically in the minds of the kids?
Not if you work as a team where the officer is working with you and he's not someone who shows up at your door in an emergency only. If he's working with you, the students understand. Let me give you one example of how the resource officers have helped us. When they gain the confidence of students, students will confide in them about things that are going on not just at the school but in the neighborhood as well. We had a recent incident where about a mile from one of our high schools, a girl was shot by two young individuals in a car. They drove by and they shot her and drove off. Well,
and killed her or injured her?
They injured her. Okay. Injured her, not life-threatening. Within an hour after we dispatched the resource officer and others, the students from the school who lived in the neighborhood confided in the resource officers, identified the subjects, and by 10 or 11 o'clock that night, we had them in custody. Now,
but wouldn't those same students have told the teacher if there wasn't a police officer there?
I'm not sure that they would that they would see the teacher's role as being someone who's going to be going out to catch these individuals. But the point of it is the police officer was filling the role as a member of the team that produces a safe environment in the school and within our district.
Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Steve's on the line there. Hi, Steve. What are you thinking?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think I bring a real unique perspective to this because I'm a single parent with two high school students, one who is an excellent student and one who is frequently in trouble. I first want to tell you that I am so grateful that there are resource officers in our high schools that it is something I can never imagine that we not have ever again.
What are the research officers that I'm going to call them police officers, just so we don't get confused in the terms here? I do understand the distinction, but what does the police officer in the school provide you, Steve, that say a counselor or a principal wouldn't or wasn't able to do?
Well, for one, for my daughter, she's the good student, and for my daughter, it offers her protection and someone that's there to help her. She's someone that she really trusts to be there to help her in crises. Mm-hmm. For my son, who's not, it's almost an extension of me. He knows he can't get away with certain behaviors, and the fact that the resource officer is there, I'm sorry, police officer, and makes it clear that he's there and watching, it curbs a lot of that behavior.
And why would the police officer be an extension of you, whereas the old system of the teacher and the principal wouldn't be an extension of you, Steve?
Frankly, I can only say that I suspect that it is just the authoritarian figure. The principal, the teacher, they always tend to be for the student in a peaceful mode. The police officer appears authoritarian.
Right.
Authority. My daughter has this really unique idea, though.
Steve, can I stop you just now, because I'm going to get a little bit too much on the table here, and I do want to go back to Richard Arum on helping us understand his perspective of the distinction between the police officer and the discipline from the school. Richard, you've been listening right. to Steve. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think Steve brings up an important point and. One that I think David would also agree with, and that is that in certain school settings, violence and disorder have become so endemic and exist at such high levels that perhaps as short-term temporary measures, we need police in our schools to ensure the safety of students. But this you know. If this is necessary to provide protection, is what Steve called for her daughter, for his daughter, it should we shouldn't rely on this as a long-term solution to our school's problems. Rather, we should look at some of the underlying causes that have produced disorder and violence in schools in the first place.
David Gordon, you're listening to Steve. Let me hear your thoughts on the situation he describes.
I would disagree with what Richard just said, because I think if you're to the point where things have deteriorated so much, the officer is far short of what you need to solve the problem. Again, I think the issue is it's not an either or. Do you have officers or don't you have officers?
Right.
But do you have them working with your school people as a team so that they're not playing the typical role of an officer? There's a crisis, come in, hook them up, take them downtown, arrest them, but in a preventative mode, working with you, being on the campus to make sure that you're looking at every possible way to protect the school, to protect the kids. That's not an authoritarian function.
Right.
It's a preventive function, and that's the way we approach it.
And Steve, back to you in Greensboro. When you look at the way that police officer affects the lives of your children, just coming off what David is saying, do you look at it as in fact, maybe a good way for your own kids to get used to how they're supposed to relate to police officers, rather than just seeing them as the ultimate good guy with the gun, someone who's more a part of the neighborhood, the community?
Absolutely, exactly right. That is exactly right. My kids, even my son, is growing fast to respect him. If I may make another comment, my daughter came up with an idea a couple of weeks ago. She's currently working on a petition in the school to get more involved with our resource officer. And what she's planning is to have a student court, if you will, so where they can be directly involved and self-discipline themselves through almost like a course in the legal system, if you will.
That's an interesting idea. Steve, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you, sir.
I want to go back to Richard Arum on something that I set aside because, Richard, I think that the legal studying that you did in preparing Judging School Discipline, the book, is something that we should let our listeners in on. I just want to go back to the case that you spoke about, Goss versus Lopez. This is the story of Dwight Lopez. Now, I'll give a quick précis. You can tell me if I get anything wrong. But this is a 19-year-old student, Central High School in Columbus, Ohio, back in 1971, was accused of being part of a student riot in the cafeteria, was suspended, said, no, I didn't do it. But he was suspended anyway, and the case went on through the courts. And ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the students, in favor of Dwight Lopez, saying that his constitutional rights to argue against the discipline were violated. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, in the book, I look at every appellate court case that occurs in this country where students are contesting school discipline. But Goss v. Lopez is particularly important because it's the Supreme Court case that established students were entitled to rudimentary due process rights when they were facing even minor day-to-day school discipline. So after Goss v. Lopez, students began contesting discipline when the matters were as minor as after-school detention, getting kicked off buses, having their grades lowered, not being able to play in a football or basketball game on the weekend.
They didn't win all these cases, but they won a number of them, right?
And then not only did they win a number of them, about a quarter or a third of the cases in the appellate courts, but the fear that it had instilled in teachers and administrators that these cases could be brought, that they could be involved in lengthy legal hearings, Wood v. Strickland, a case immediately following Goss v. Lopez, also in 1975, held administrators and teachers personally liable, that is, their personal property would be subject to penalty if they knowingly violated students' due process rights. It really had a chilling effect in kind of how teachers and administrators involve themselves.
This was the case when a couple of girls were accused of spiking the punch in home ec class, and eventually the courts ruled that the girls' rights may have been so badly violated that, as you point out, school officials could be personally, financially liable for damages, right?
Right. That's correct. I also want to say one other thing about these cases that's very interesting. In the initial period, 1968 to 1975, when the case law was established in this area, the cases largely involved students exercising First Amendment rights or political protests. Goss v. Lopez, students were protesting the lack of African-American curriculum in their high school. The Tinker case, well-known Tinker case, students were protesting the Vietnam War. Again, more than 50% of the cases involved First Amendment or political protests.
You're saying the First Amendment cases were okay, kids should have those rights, but challenging school discipline in court, that's what's caused the problem.
Exactly. And since 1975, the cases no longer are about those matters. They're about violence, drugs, weapons, general misbehavior. 10% or less of the cases now are involved First Amendment or political issues in any way.
Let me stop you there. An interesting look back on how it is that the school discipline situation has come to be the way it is today in schools. And we're inviting you into our conversation, Judging School Discipline. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour we're talking about school discipline. We certainly see all the stories in the newspapers about different ways that the zero tolerance policies are being exercised, raising questions in our mind about whether or not that's the right way to do things, what better solutions might be available. David Gordon is with us from the Elk Grove Unified School District in California, where they're trying to take advantage of the relationship that police officers in the school, I call them resource officers, can have with the kids. We also have with us Richard Arum. He's got a new book out called Judging School Discipline, The Crisis of Moral Authority. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We're going next to Raleigh, North Carolina. And Andre, you're with us. Hi.
How you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I want to say something that should be obvious to most people. The military has parents who are having children go to school, but they're in the military. And the reason why I bring up that unique correlation is because the parents are 100% responsible for the children's action in school, even when they're not there. So therefore, anything your child does, you're accountable for. So that affects your career, your ability to earn everything. And it brings us back to the point that we reap the benefits of our children, so we have to take the responsibility. If parents knew that, you know, they could be held liable for their children's actions, they would be more concerned about the actions, and they would take more time to look into the things that the teachers are calling and telling them. It's obvious that when they feel their child has been wrong, they're 100% apt to take action in the behalf of their child. So when their child is shown and deemed to be at fault, they need to take that same action with the same amount of vigor.
That's
not what happened. You know, what they're doing is when it looks like there may be profit to be gained or they feel that, you know, their child's wrong, they jump to action. But when their child is shown to be at fault, then it's, oh, well, he's just a kid. You know, you have to hold your children responsible. And in some cases, the only way parents will feel the need to do that as if they're held responsible.
David, how do you manage that at Elk Grove? I think it's a really interesting perspective that Andre's put on the table, because I, as a parent, I have a choice. I can say, nope, darn right, do what the school tells you to do, or I can leap to the defense of my child regardless of whatever my daughter or son has done as a sort of protection thing. Is this something that you deal with as a superintendent?
It's something we spend a lot of time on, and it begins with the Board of Education in their conversation, their discussions, emphasizing school safety, proper discipline is a top priority. That word gets out. Then, as you saw, the code of conduct, we mail it to every parent. It's on our website. We say, please read it, because when we call you in, if there's been an infraction, and tell you we're suspending your child, we want you to know exactly why, and we want you to remember that we told you about the rules and we asked that you discuss them with your child. I think that's what provides the legitimacy to parents. And the final point is, when we're wrong, we're wrong. We follow all of the legal procedures we're supposed to, and sometimes we don't do it properly, and in those cases the parent is right, and we correct it. And strive to do better in the future.
Yeah. Dick, I would just add that I think the caller, Andre, brings up a very interesting natural experiment. The schools children in the military attend. There's been some preliminary research in these schools. Discipline clearly works in these schools. And interestingly, some of the racial gaps in learning that we see in society at large largely disappear in these settings.
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I find in my book that when African American students report that discipline has moral authority, that is, that when it's both perceived as being strict and fair, there is no test gap with white students. Unfortunately, African American students in our country are concentrated in schools where discipline is ineffective and not working. They're concentrated in schools where discipline is either authoritarian or alternatively too lenient. But in either case, they're concentrated in schools with many behavioral problems, and where discipline is simply ineffective.
And I was reading about that in your hometown now of New York City, where they try these borough academies and crossroads academies and second opportunity schools. Now they're calling them New Beginning Centers. But again, again and again and again, they are sort of holding places, trying to deal with the sorts of problems that come from exactly the schools that you're describing. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Adrian's on the line. Hi, Adrian. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I'm a public school teacher. I've been teaching for 7 years. I also coach various sports. And something I've been related to by my parents, you know, I'm a little too young to remember, but back in the Civil Rights Movement, and when the schools were integrated, my mother, who's also a teacher, says that has had a great effect on the discipline problems. Because as Andre was saying, with the moral authority coming with the teachers, the integration of black teachers into white schools and you know, schools becoming one, the teachers lost a lot of their authority at that point in time.
Are you saying white teachers or black teachers lost authority? You saying that it was the authority was lost due to race, Adrian?
I'm saying that the authority, what was related to me by my mother, because I didn't go through the integration, but black teachers used to be able to put hands on the black students, or the communities were more tightly woven, and so that the teacher knew the parents a lot of times, mm-hmm. or they really had that moral authority and wherewithal to deal with a black student one-on-one. And as was stated, the black students oftentimes don't feel the legitimacy of the majority rule.
David, is this something that comes up in Elk Grove? I know your school district's a well-mixed one.
Yeah, it really hasn't come up because I think California is very different from much of the rest of the country in the mixture of races and religions. We have, in our district, spoken 80 different languages. We have large proportions of Asian Americans, African Americans, Latinos, and so on. And I think there's more emphasis on we all have to learn to live together because this is our culture. And frankly, this is going to be America in 20 or 30 years. And it's something that we work hard on. How do we live together presently and prospectively?
Richard, let me hear from you here.
Yeah, well, I actually think the caller brings up an important point here. Desegregation of our schools and our society is perhaps one of the most important positive changes that occurred in the 20th century in our country, and one that we all support and celebrate. However, it did have some unintended consequences, and one of them was in segregated schools, African American students were largely supervised by African American teachers, and in those settings, discipline was not politically charged, and certainly this was well before Goss v. Lopez, and so there was not a legal institutional apparatus around it at all. Discipline worked well. Socialization in those schools often worked well as well. And so, yes, problems because of desegregation, again, something that all of us would defend, protect, celebrate, disciplinary problems perhaps have grown.
And Adrian, just from your perspective as a teacher, I mean, we're obviously not going back to segregation, at least not intentionally. So what's the solution?
Well, I don't advocate returning to segregation. Don't get me wrong.
No, I understand you.
I was just making the point that that's a factor. I think the solution is, as a teacher, having an administration that's willing to back you up, having a court system that is willing to take action at maybe the second offense level rather than waiting till the fifth or seventh or tenth offense that a child commits. Because once a child learns that, hey, I've been to court once, I got arrested once, and nothing happened, they expect to continue to be able to do these things. And just like any other conditioned response, they will continue to offend until they receive a sanction, a serious sanction.
Adrian, can I just bring you to the point, though, that we've been talking about earlier in the program, and that is that if the students know that the schools have the authority and they don't automatically have recourse to the courts, does that make it any easier to manage discipline at the school level?
Well, it would. If the student knew that the teacher had any authority,
right,
then that would stop it right there in the classroom. But the teacher's authority has been stripped, and then the dean of students oftentimes has very little power. And even going up to the principal, if there's been, for example, at one point in my career, I saw a student smoking marijuana on school grounds. I reported this. The student was found to be intoxicated. The smell of marijuana was on the student. The student was suspended for 10 days, but when they returned the next day with their parent and they had sought counsel, the student was readmitted to school. It was obvious that the student had been using marijuana. But then the parent's question to me was, well, why didn't you take it from him? Now, had I taken it, then I would have been up for assault charges for putting my hands on a child. You know, so that's where students have the power and the administration and teachers don't.
Adrian, I want to thank you for your call.
Sure.
And we're going to go straight to Lowell, Massachusetts. Jack's been listening along with us. And Jack, you've got some firsthand experience here. You work as a police officer in a school, as a school resource officer, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell me what you think about what you've heard so far.
Well, what I wanted to comment on earlier was the fact that the problem I have so often when parents come into a school that I'm assigned to and they see me standing there in my uniform and my bulletproof vest, and they immediately think that the school is rife with violence, or they'll think that all the schools in this city that they have just moved their child to, for instance, they're rife with violence. And it's just not the case at all. The schools are very, very safe, and the incidence of violence in the schools is rare. I'm assigned to a K-8 school as well as the high school here. And the school resource officer program that we run, is a program of prevention and intervention.
I wonder if this is a generational thing, Jack, that those of us who went to elementary school in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s would automatically think that a man wearing a bulletproof vest in a school classroom is a sign that there's real trouble there.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that that is their reaction. But, I mean, when I put my uniform on, I put that bulletproof vest on because you never know what's going to happen. But let me just tell you my experience at the high school. When I was first assigned there, and we have a significant gang problem in this city, and when I was first assigned there, I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be crazy with all the gang kids. And so I did a study of the students who had been suspended for fighting. And what I found out was that it only involved, of all the fights at the school last year, only six of them involved a gang member fighting a gang member one-on-one, and only one fight involved an incident where there were more than one gang member fighting other gang members. So even the incidence of gang violence is rare. And so often my role at the high school is to intervene when a student comes and says, you know, I think I may end up in a fight, or I heard that there's going to be a fight. We intervene at that point, speak to the students, and refer them to mediation.
Jack, I want to stop you there because I want to make room here for just to get a last comment from my two guests. Richard, was that you coming in there?
Yeah, I was just going to jump in by saying maybe there's not a real problem with violence in the schools in Lowell, Massachusetts, nor in Elk Grove, Sacramento. But there is indeed a real problem with violence and disorder in our schools. And let me just give you some statistics on...
I'll ask you to be quick because we're right near the end of the program.
14% of urban public school teachers were threatened with injury last year. 6% of urban public school teachers were physically attacked. I think that's a level of disorder that is intolerable. The question really is not does violence and disorder exist in the schools, but how to fix it.
And David Gordon, if you look ahead 10 years, can you imagine a time when police officers are out of the schools, or simply imagine a time where the students and the parents have a different attitude about the officers there?
I think we're already seeing a different attitude in our community. Lou Blanis, our county sheriff, is high profile, and we're out there together explaining the program that we have, and I commend Jack and his program. I think you're going to see continued collaboration with schools and law enforcement and the community, because it's together, all of us working together, which is going to keep our children safe. And I invite you or Richard or any of your callers to come and visit us in Elk Grove. We have a program I think works.
Well, if I get out that way, I'll take you up on that. David, thanks for being with us. David Gordon is superintendent of the Elk Grove Unified School District in Sacramento County, California. Richard Arum, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Richard Arum is sociology and education professor at New York University and author of a new book called Judging School Discipline, The Crisis of Moral Authority. If you're interested in exchanging ideas and views about what you've heard on the program this hour, we invite you to our forum pages. We are at www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.